Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for waiting. All lines have been placed on listen-only mode, and the floor will be open for your questions and comments following the presentation. Without further ado, it is my pleasure to turn the floor over to your host, Ms. Annie Beigel from the New York State Department of Health. Ms. Beigel, the floor is yours.
Okay, thanks a lot, Les, and welcome to everybody. And I just want to thank you on behalf of the New York State Department of Health's Tobacco Control Program, the New York State Tobacco Cessation Centers, and the New York State Smokers Quit Line, and welcome you to today's conference call, Health Disparities in Tobacco Use and Success in Tobacco Cessation, with our featured speaker, Dr. Hal Strelnick, Professor of Clinical, Family, and Social Medicine at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. In New York and in the United States, we've made tremendous strides in bringing down the prevalence of tobacco use with both adults and youth. However, there remains disparate groups whose prevalence has not changed over the last several years. So today's call will provide an in-depth look at these groups and discuss effective approaches to helping them quit. But before we do that, there's just a couple of housekeeping things. We are pleased to offer continuing education hours today, including CME, CEU, OASIS clock hours, and CRCE. But to fulfill these requirements of continuing education credit, we're required to disclose the following. Dr. Strelnick has no real or perceived vested interests that relate to this presentation, nor does he have any relationships with pharmaceutical companies and or corporations whose products or services are related to pertinent therapeutic areas. So to obtain continuing education credit, you need to follow the instructions on the course credit and evaluation forms, which are posted on the website. And please remember, applications for credit will not be accepted after June 17th. That's a week from this Friday. So please be sure to submit your applications as soon as possible to receive credit. And so now it's my pleasure to hand the call over to Dr. Hal Strelnick. Dr. Strelnick?
Thank you, Annie. And I look forward to a dialogue at the end of this discussion. This presentation began with a conversation in January of 2009 with Dr. Jeffrey Willett, the director of the Tobacco Control Program at the New York State Department of Health Disparities Summit, and then was facilitated, and I should thank Lisa Marini from Queens Quits for a discussion we had in the fall of 2010 that led to this presentation. So as Annie mentioned, I have no conflicts, and the disclosure statement substantiates that. And the learning objectives for this presentation, which is the third slide, involves identifying the relationships between health disparities and tobacco use in different groups and focusing on how to adapt the standard skills for tobacco cessation to particular individuals and understanding background of their groups. If we go to the fourth slide, we can see in the age-adjusted lung cancer mortality rates by race and ethnicity and sex from 2007, that African-American men have much higher rates of lung cancer deaths than all other groups, men and women. And on the next slide, we can see with all site cancer mortality that African-American men and African-American women have higher death rates. And as you know, smoking is related to almost all forms of cancer, and this is a disparity which has gotten worse over the years. That's represented in the next slide, looking at age-adjusted lung cancer rates between white and African-American males from 1950, when white had higher rates than African Americans, and as time has passed, African American rates have risen, peaking in the early 1990s, and the rate is still considerably higher for African American men as of 2007. So this is a problem that has gotten worse and which we largely attribute to smoking. The consequences of tobacco industry's marketing practices suggest that this is not an accident. This has been a focus of the industry in trying to promote the use of cigarettes in communities of color and among particular groups. So on the slide reading disparities in tobacco marketing, we can see that both in-store and over-the-counter promotions for tobacco products seem to target racial and ethnic communities disproportionately. So you will see this kind of advertising in small corner mom-and-pop shops, bodegas, and the like, in disproportion to other shops in communities that are more middle class or more of predominant groups. There's also been specific orientation towards the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transsexual community in targeting these groups by advertising in the gay media, sponsoring specific gay events, and contributing to HIV and AIDS organizations that highlight the products. And as you know, the industry has also targeted women since the early 1900s, and that we have discovered more recently that the proximity of tobacco outlets actually affects the ability for people to successfully quit. If you live near many of these small outlets that advertise cigarettes, it's harder for you to be successful in quitting. And the next slide shows a typical advertisement to the communities of color, suggesting that the only choice is between whether to smoke regular or menthol cigarettes. On the next slide, we see the two most popular menthol cigarettes among African Americans, Newports and Kools, and how this is specifically targeted to these audiences. There are also disparities in when people begin to smoke. Most Asian and African American smokers begin later in life, as young adults rather than as early teens, and that we have learned that Hispanics and Asians who do not speak English smoke less and have lower risks than those who have predominantly or prefer English. And, of course, English is a mark of acculturation. Low income predicts when young people begin smoking, and, of course, the children of low-income people are more likely to try smoking. And in particular, as those advertisements showed, menthol cigarettes are specifically marketed to youth and minorities. And compared to whites, who about a third of whom who smoke menthol cigarettes, almost half of Hispanics, and more than 80% of African Americans choose menthol cigarettes as a result of these efforts. There are also current disparities in tobacco use. The lower education, higher rates of smoking. So 42% of those with only a GED are smokers. Those with mental health problems, more than 80% smoke, with compounding the challenges of efforts to reduce and help people stop smoking. Disabled adults are more than 50% more likely to smoke than non-disabled adults, and lesbian and bisexual girls smoke at rates sixfold more than heterosexual girls. Similarly, young Native Americans smoke and African Americans who are born here are more likely to smoke than those who immigrate from Africa or the Caribbean. Interestingly, African Americans smoke fewer cigarettes per day, but take fewer puffs per cigarette, but smoke and they generally smoke higher nicotine content and have higher rates of menthol use and slower cottoning metabolism. There has also been a marked increase in menthol smoking among African Americans. It was as low as 5% in 1953. It rose to 44% in the mid-70s and was, as we pointed out, over 80% in 2007. If we look at current smoking among all adults on the next slide, by race and ethnicity, you can see that African American men and Native American and American Indian men and women smoke at higher rates than whites. The group that smokes the least are Asians and Hispanics. On the next slide, we can see a slightly different pattern among young people, looking at youth ages 12 to 17 and their smoking rates. And here, blacks and Hispanics youth have a distinct advantage and smoke at much lower rates along with the Asians. But Native American and American Indian, Alaska Native youth smoke at rates, both boys and girls, at much higher rates than whites. On the next slide, showing the current status of ever smokers, we can see that in comparison to whites, blacks are more likely to be current smokers and intermittent smokers rather than former smokers. Hispanics are less likely to be current smokers, but more likely to be intermittent, as are Asians. So the patterns of how people smoke vary according to the racial and ethnic group which they are in. Here is, on the next slide, we're looking at the historical pattern of adult smokers, the prevalence of smoking by sex and race from 1965 to 2008. And you can see that the disparity in the 60s, which was quite dramatic in smoking rates, with African American men smoking more than 60%, these have narrowed, but African American men continue to have the highest smoking rate, followed by white men and with white women having rates higher than African American women. So to the next slide, we see a pattern that's somewhat different than on the previous slide, where there was a narrowing of the prevalence between different groups, that looking at those in poverty compared to those above poverty, smoking rates have almost not budged in the last 20 plus years. So those below poverty continue to have considerably higher smoking rates than those below poverty. On the next slide, we look at this pattern regarding education and the prevalence rates of smoking by education. And as you can see, the group with the highest prevalence of smoking consistently over the last 25 years have been those without a high school education. Doing only slightly better are those high school graduates, but considerably better those who go on to some college and college graduates. So the last two slides show that we have not made as much progress in what one would call the using income and education as a way of thinking about social class. We've not made the same progress in reaching the lowest social classes that we have with middle and upper social classes in the SES or socioeconomic status. If we look at the next slide, this is focused on New York. On the left, the comparison between 2000 and 2009 demonstrates the progress that we've made through the many efforts, both public health and individual cessation efforts, to lower the smoking rate. On the right, the comparison shows that we've made progress with both men and women. On the next slide, however, we have a more complicated story. The circle shows the success that we've had in reducing smoking among young people, ages 18 to 44, and looking on the right-hand area, so the circle focuses on the success, the lack of success that is reflected in older adults is something that is particularly true among African Americans. So for those 45 to 65, and particularly those 65 and older, African Americans have higher rates of smoking than whites. And while those over 65, African Americans over 65, have lower rates than the national average, there's been almost no decline in the smoking rate of blacks of 65 years and older since 1965. Going on to current smoking in New York State by race and ethnicity, we can see that we've made progress in all groups. There's been improvements among whites, blacks, Hispanics, and all others. In the next slide, we're looking at current smoking by income, and again, we're focused on the challenges that we are facing with low-income people. While all groups above incomes of $15,000 or more have shown declines in smoking over the decade of the 2000s, those low-income people under 15,000 in New York State have shown an increase in their smoking rate. This is similar to the slides we showed where the education and income were not eliminating this disparity between the middle class and the lower and working class. This is a way of looking at it using education. We've made progress with those with a high school diploma, college, or a college degree, but not progress with those who have less than a high school education. These reflect this in New York State what is going on nationally. There are disparities in how many cigarettes are smoked per day by individuals. Those who are exposed to unemployment early in life have rates of smoking twice that of those who don't. Those with blue-collar jobs and farm workers smoke more than a pack a day, a quarter of compared to only 18% of white-collar workers, or a 33% increase over the white-collar. While African-Americans, Hispanics, and Asians are light or have more lighter smokers, there are fewer interventions that have been shown to be targeting light smokers and to be effective with light smokers. And as African-Americans smoke fewer cigarettes per day than whites, but have higher serum cotinine levels, showing that they have different metabolism related to nicotine in the body compared to whites, Mexican-Americans, and Asians. On the next slide, looking at cigarette consumption for smokers by racial and ethnic groups, the blue indicates those who smoke less than a half a pack a day. The red, from 11 to cigarettes to 20 per day, and the orange over a pack a day. And the light smokers, or the less than half a pack a day smokers, are much more common among blacks, Hispanics, and Asians than for whites. On the next slide, we're going to look about quitting. For those who have ever smoked, a third of those under the federal poverty line, which is what FPL stands for, have quit smoking, while more than half of those above the federal poverty line have quit, or a 47% difference. A third of service workers, compared to more than half of white-collar workers, report being ex-smokers. So there we have a 55% lower rate of ex-smokers among those two different groups of workers. Only a third of women who quit smoking during pregnancy remain abstinent after 1 year, so there's a considerable 67% or two-thirds of women will relapse and begin smoking in the first year when they have a small child at home. Women living in high unemployment areas are also much more likely to smoke. So it's not just whether you and your family has been exposed to unemployment, but in neighborhoods with higher unemployment, there's more likely for individuals, and particularly women, to smoke. And the last point on this slide shows that African Americans are more likely to try to quit. They report higher rates of quit attempts, but they are less likely to succeed. And we'll come back to that in a moment. Now, menthol cigarettes, and this you'll find this is sort of a anti-menthol commercial, if one thinks of it as public health detailing as opposed to a commercial. The issue of menthol is very important in communities of color. Despite the fact that African Americans and Latinos, as we have seen, smoke fewer cigarettes per day, menthol smokers who are African American and Latino are less successful when they try to quit. Now, that's not true among whites. It does not make a difference among whites whether they smoke menthol cigarettes or regular cigarettes. For those who are treated with a bupropion, who are under 50 years of age, menthol smokers were less likely to succeed in quitting. And African-American menthol smokers were also less successful when using bupropion compared to African-Americans who smoked regular cigarettes. And menthol smokers have lower rates of cessation, fewer recent quit attempts, and higher risk of relapse. And the theory is that the menthol soothes the inhalation and allows the smoker to draw in more smoke with each puff rather than and hold it longer. So in the next slide, we're going to look at the percentage of adult smokers who have been advised to quit by the racial and ethnic groups. And the good news is that we've made considerable progress among all groups, with increases from 1992 and 93 to 2003 in the number of individuals who smoke who have reported that they've been advised to quit by their physician or another healthcare professional. However, you can see in this slide that African Americans and Hispanics have continued to be less likely to be advised to quit than are Asians and whites. And this is one of the challenges that we face in trying to promote cessation for every smoker in every practice when a patient is encountered. The next slide shows the types of cessation aids that people use. And in almost all groups, individuals will try going cold turkey or gradually reducing the amount of smoking as they approach their own efforts to quit. Only in whites is nicotine replacement therapy, or NRT, the next most common. Blacks switch more to lighter cigarettes than they use nicotine replacement therapy. Hispanics use family support and more than NRT, and Asians rely on family support and lighter cigarettes more than NRT. And unfortunately, as this slide indicates, the quit line is the last of the seven approaches that are used by smokers. On the next slide, it shows a study about race and nicotine replacement therapy. This was a study that was conducted looking at the Medicaid patients in Minnesota, and with 8 months of follow-up, they found what is presented here on the left, the 7 days prevalence of abstinence, and on the right, the 30-day abstinence following the use of the nicotine replacement therapy. And what they found was that whites, African Americans, and Native Americans all benefited about the same from nicotine replacement therapy. Asian seems to do somewhat better, though this is not a statistically significant difference, though it looks that way on the graph. And when the study was looked at a multivariate analysis to control for all the confounding variables and response bias, they found that there was really no evidence that nicotine replacement therapy was not as effective among minority groups as among white smokers, and in fact, in some cases, probably better. Disparities for youth, only 34% of youth were reported that they were advised to quit smoking. The smoking cessation rates in hospitals are lower for black patients, and there are many groups that are less likely to get advice to quit, including people of color, younger patients, the uninsured. Those people are healthy, who don't use services often, or light smokers, or who have lower education. And we noted that lower education was a risk in and of itself. This is a list of what low-income smokers report, why they smoke, the good things about it, the kind of help with stress, boredom, smoking being a companion and a loyal friend, the fact that it was a legal drug, and many of the negatives. And, of course, when talking to patients using the five A's, this is certainly something to remember to tailor your discussion with a smoker about what is relevant and what will be helpful. Among African Americans with a Project Kaleidoscope, which looked particularly at the issue of smoking, there was the focus groups that they conducted showed that it was very important that people have a sense of belonging, that they wanted to give back, that African Americans understood the health messages that they heard or read or saw on television, but that they didn't always believe that the healthcare system understood them or could follow their journeys and the challenges that smoking presented to them. They often felt that the framework of disease was scary, and that it was much better to talk about health and wellness, and that the LGBT community was particularly hesitant in the African American community about cessation initiatives. There was more of an interest when people focused on culturally relevant issues rather than clinical or statistical ones in discussions about cessation. And this slide about facts on African American spirituality introduces how important that spirituality as it comes to into play in smoking cessation. African Americans report higher rates than whites and other groups of being spiritual, of being born again, lower rates of being unchurched, so people are affiliated with a religious institution. They have they report that faith is important to them, and that the faith is, in particular, an important source of strength. And in looking at the 40 Days to Freedom on the next slide, a tobacco cessation course that was developed for African Americans in their churches, you can see with the highest bar on this graph in terms of the preferred section of the course was focusing on the power of prayer. The steps to quit follow next, and the reasons to quit follow that. But you can see in that hierarchy of how important a issue in the African American community is the power of prayer in helping overcome the challenges of nicotine addiction. That may not be in most people's clinical vocabulary, but it may be a way of encouraging patients to consider this. On the community level, there have been efforts in the African American community, one under the aegis of My Body is My Temple, and I think the framework of the responsibility of the body as your spiritual home focused on that model for bringing the consciousness of how smoking affects that. Now, turning to the next slide on culturally relevant issues for Latino smokers, I wanted to just highlight very quickly a series of terms that are been described sort of the dominant Latino culture. Of course, no individual is a stereotype of this, but these are ideas that may be of great relevance. Familismo means the focus on the family. Personalismo reflects Latin culture's importance of personal relationships. Respeto means respect and the importance of respect between the patient and the provider. Simpatia would be easily translated into sympathy. Confianza is trust, or the notion that there's a mutual obligation that helps develop that respect and that personal relation. The issue that is widespread in popular culture about machismo, which is sort of the strength, but also a sense of responsibility for providing, and fatalismo, sort of the challenges of the higher powers are often in play. And these often contrast to the dominant, more individualistic orientation of the dominant American culture, which is highlighted on the right. So I'm going to briefly speak about a couple that Mr. Brown and his wife, Ms. Perez, were expecting a child. This couple is has the opportunity to take advantage of the both the family history and on Mr. Brown's side and the expectation of a new child to have, be motivated around some of these issues of familismo and personalismo, as well as the spiritual connection in order to encourage these expectant parents to pursue use of the quit line, referring them to the back to quit, and helping them with nicotine replacement therapy in going forward and trying to be mutually supportive of each other in quitting together for their future family. The next slide looks at secondhand smoke, which over time African Americans have had higher rates of secondhand smoke. This is in part on the next slide. We're looking at home smoking bans by racial and ethnic group. The blue bars represent all households, but the red bars represent those households with a smoker. And you can see that Latinos and Asians as a group have higher rates of household smoking bans, but African Americans have had less. And on the next slide, this has not gone unrecognized, and there was a campaign developed in the early part of the decade called Not in My Mama's Kitchen that focused on the importance of the African-American family and the matriarchal notions about the kitchen of how to assure that people were not smoking, and there's been considerable success of this particular approach. On the next slide, the African-American community mobilization, because the tobacco companies have created brands, both X and Uptown, which very explicitly targeted the African-American community, and there has been considerable resistance to that, and the success of those mobilizations have been the withdrawal of these cigarettes from the market. On the next slide, looking at the African-American community mobilization around Say No to Joe Menthol, we are looking at the efforts to expand Camel Cigarettes menthol into the African-American community, and a group called the National Association of African-Americans for Positive Imagery, or NAPI for short, led the efforts to get these advertising campaigns out of the communities and even led a boycott with Walgreens drugstores. Looking at the next slide, the New York State quit line, these are the percentages of users by race, ethnicity in the upper left-hand corner, by educational level right below that, and by the income or the insurance status in the right-hand side. And you can see that compared to the average insurance status of a New Yorker, the uninsured take advantage of the quitline at higher rates, but whites and the and there's an even pretty even distribution of who uses the quitline. There's been research from California that's shown that African Americans and whites are equally likely to use the and to have heard of the quitline and to take advantage of that. Observations here in the Bronx is that low-income Medicaid patients, African Americans and Latinos, are much more likely to call if they've heard from their health provider, and that they much larger percentage of low-income people are motivated to reach for the quit line when they speak and hear from their provider that that's the best way for them to go. So the take-home points for the quit line and nicotine replacement therapy work for people of color. They learn about the quit lines from the media and healthcare providers more than the average citizen, that you have to tailor your cessation interventions to the individual and their values, which may take extra time to determine, whether it be spirituality or feminalismo or personalismo, that statistics are less effective, but you have to explore this. You cannot make assumptions that any of this is true about any particular individual. And in particular, you have to recognize the particular challenges that menthol smokers face when they try to quit. So the last slide is just resources on tobacco and health disparities, and that's for your use. And now I'm going to hand the call over to Paula Celestino from the New York State Quitline before we have Q&A.
Thank you, Dr. Strelnick. That was an excellent presentation, and I found it really informative, and I appreciate your words about the quitline and some of the information you shared about the quitline. The New York State Smokers Quitline does its best to reach these disparate populations. When these folks do call us, we have trained coaches ready to provide education and information tailored to their specific needs. We have messages that try to help those who call us that are Medicaid members to take advantage of their benefit. If they have particular chronic diseases, they are coached on the benefits of quitting and how it will help manage their chronic diseases. We have special materials in several different languages, along with a translation service that makes it a little bit easier for us to provide coaching and information to these folks. We've recently partnered with the Quitline in California to provide Asian-speaking clients with Asian-speaking coaches so that, again, we can tailor more of the services to folks, to their particular needs. In addition to that, we've teamed with the Department of Corrections, so we do service the incarcerated community. And we've done some special programs with the New York State Diabetes and Prevention Control Program to see how we can coordinate better referrals among our programs. So we kind of do what we can to get the folks to us and to tailor our messages and our cessation services, you know, to the different populations. And I think one of the things that Dr. Strelnick pointed out was that it looks, relatively speaking, like the quit line doesn't serve a large portion of percentage of the special populations. The quitline in general services, you know, about 3 to 5% of the smokers in New York. At one time or another, they've called us. It's a chronic disease. They do come back. But we clearly need to get better at streamlining these folks to services that are available. And I think the emphasis on the provider messages and helping them link to the quitline and other services should be noted. The quitline is working very hard to set up electronic data exchanges through the new EMR system so that there's a more systematic way of helping providers triage their patients into services at the quitline and some other some other services. The quitline can be used as a portal to then get the information to these folks about what's available in their community or through their insurance companies. So I think that's really the vision of the quitline in terms of more proactively being able to help these folks, and the name of the game really is to get these folks utilizing the services. So with your help and with your partnership, I hope that we can do that, and myself and Pat Bax, who works at the quitline with many of you, stand ready to nurture any partnerships or ideas or help that we can provide for you to help, triage these folks into our services and hopefully get them on their way to, quit attempts and ultimately quitting. So I think that's my spiel for now. And at this point, we will open it up to some Q&A.
Certainly, the floor is open for your questions. If you have a question, please press the number 7 or letter Q on your telephone keypad. Again, for a question or comment, please press the number 7 or letter Q on your telephone keypad. First question comes from Patricia Breist. Patricia, the floor is yours.
Oh, hi. Actually, it's Leslie Holmberg talking, and I have a question regarding the increased incidence in unusual cancers, especially in the African-American population. I believe there's some speculation out there that these are due to a breakdown of the byproducts of menthol in the cigarettes. And I would be interested to know if there was any more research being done on this, as I think this is an extremely powerful tool to be used when we talk about targeted and cultural sensitivity.
The challenge of menthol is currently being reviewed by the Food and Drug Administration. The law that President Obama assigned in 2009, which gave regulatory authority over tobacco to the Food and Drug Administration, had a carve-out that basically gave menthol a pass until this review takes place. And I think the issues related there. The issues are very diverse and very serious around menthol, and I think the more that the FDA hears from the tobacco cessation community that their investigation of these potential additional risks, as well as the challenges that menthol smokers, particularly in the community of colors, experience with quitting and the uptake of the dosing of the nicotine and the other chemicals in the cigarette are really important. So I don't have an answer to that question about is there compelling evidence that there is a connection between the breakdown products of menthol and increased risk for unusual cancers. But I think that's the domain of that going forward will be the FDA, and we should be pressing them to make to claim the responsibility and to provide as much information, oversight, and research on menthol as possible.
Thank you. The next question comes from Don Kleiss. Don, the floor is yours.
Yes. My question is specifically, are you aware of any research for NRT dosing with people with addictions?
I have a colleague that is looking at that issue in particular, but I think the assumption could be that in general that there's that you can you might start with someone with a opiate addiction that's in methadone maintenance would have a higher metabolism rate for nicotine, and you might consider starting at a higher dose than you might just by the usual methods. I don't know that there's strong evidence. There's increasing amounts of attention to the high smoking rates for those with particularly opiate addictions in methadone maintenance programs. But I do not know personally that information, but that would be my inclination.
Thank you.
Thank you. Again, for a question or comment, please press the number 7 or letter Q on your telephone keypad. Next question comes from Aline Sedaniel. Aline, the floor is yours.
Yes. When it comes to smokers that are above or below the poverty line, do you have any idea of why smokers below the poverty line are less likely to quit? Is it because they can't pay for the cessation aids, or because they're less educated in the importance of cessation, or?
I would be the research specifically about much of what I presented was about the prevalence and success rates and the New York State data showing that the rates of smoking have increased in that group. I will report sort of anecdotally that when the state of Massachusetts expanded its Medicaid program and its and included the extensive use of nicotine replacement therapy through its Medicaid program, which happened in 2006, there was a dramatic drop in the smoking rates of low-income individuals. So I would speculate that a significant portion of that resistance to the efforts of to reduce the overall smoking rate in that, and among that population is related to their access to the nicotine replacement therapy as well as the oral medications, the bupropion and varenicline. And to, that's been a – that was very dramatic improvement over 2 years after the expansion of the Medicaid program to cover all of the cessation therapies as well as to pay the providers for cessation counseling. And New York State has just begun to do that and expand. It began with youth and pregnant women, and now it's expanding that more recently.
Thank you.
Thank you again for a question or comment. Please press the number 7 or letter Q on your telephone keypad. Next question comes from Marianne Blante. Marianne, the floor is yours.
Hi, this is Sue Casanova, actually. My question is regarding the folks with income under $15,000. I wonder if that's been adjusted to account for the fact that a disproportionate number of the folks with developmental disabilities, mental illness, and substance abuse with those high smoking rates are included in those in that poverty, or if that folks, or if that's been adjusted for that.
I believe that the data that was presented is unadjusted, and it doesn't account for sort of the disproportionate risks that you just described, that because people in those populations do have much higher rates of smoking, and I think there's been fewer extensive efforts to address those risks in those populations. It's a considerable challenge, but there is work going on, certainly in the substance abuse area, and also with some of the developmental disability groups that are beginning to focus on this issue. But I think you make a very good point that there are numerous contributors. Similarly, when you look at education, because many of these are the same people that have not completed their education, and it's the cause and effect is not always that the income or the education is the cause. It's more of the effect.
Thank you again for a question or comment. Please press the number 7 or letter Q on your telephone keypad.
And Les, this is Annie Beigel. I think we have time for one more question, and then we'll need to bring the call to a close. So if there's a question, can you bring it forward now?
Certainly. As a reminder, if you have a question or comment, please press the number 7 or letter Q on your telephone keypad. At this time, there are no further questions.
Okay. All right. I want to thank you. And I wanted to, I know Dr. Strelnick just touched on this, but as of April 1st, Medicaid is now covering smoking cessation counseling for up to 6 sessions per year, and this includes individual and group counseling. In September, our call will be providing an overview of this benefit. We'll talk about counseling methods based on the clinical practice guideline, billing and coding information as well, and that call is going to take place on September 7th. So our Medicaid office is now covering both pharmacotherapy and counseling for all Medicaid-eligible enrollees. And our next conference call is only 2 weeks away from now. That'll be on June the 29th. The topic will be treating smokers with mental illness. Our featured speaker will be Dr. Jill Williams. So I'm hoping you will all tune back in a couple of weeks. And this brings us to the end of today's call. And I want to thank all of you for participating today. I want to thank you, Dr. Strelnick, for your excellent presentation, and Paula, the information on the New York State Smokers Quitline. And I hope all of you can stay cool in a very hot day today. So thank you all, and have a good day.
Thank you. That does conclude today's teleconference. We appreciate your participation. You may now disconnect your line at this time.